Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Nightlight. Step away from the mainstream and gather around as we enlighten the world and our realities and travel this cosmic journey we call life. Join us as we share with you and provide that beacon that can guide us all to a better way. Explore with us as we examine a metaphysical montage of spiritual insights covering everything from the mundane to the magical, UFOs to unicorns, and everything in between. This is a time of awakening, of sharing and evolving, of spreading our wings and soaring on the cosmic breath of creation. Come and join with other light-minded spirits as we weave our lights together to seek understanding, enlightenment, and with a little luck, some wisdom. This is Nightlight, a reminder that you are never alone.
Welcome everyone to another episode of Nightlight. Hope everyone enjoyed the 3-day weekend. Last week we promoted Jackie and Bill Kousalis's Bridging the Tragedy, the Mothman Festival and Museum. The listeners seemed to really enjoy that one on in the other cryptid shows we've done, and we have more in the works. Tonight we'll be delving into another audience favorite, visitors to America long before Columbus. You can hear all three of tonight's guests at the AAPS conference in October. Judy Johnson is a return guest, and she is the producer. You can view the AAPS website at aapscopper.com. Jill Baker will be presenting on America's Prehistoric Horses. You can learn more about Jill, her artwork, and writings at jillbaker.com. J. Stuart Wakefield is the author of several books on transatlantic crossings, Rocks and Rose, How the Sun God Reached America, and The Copper Trade. All three books can be found on Amazon and at Ancient American Magazine's bookstore. That website is ancientamerican.com. You can order from there, keep Wayne busy. Just want to welcome Judy, Jill, and Jay, the three J's. How's everyone doing tonight?
Pretty good, thank you.
Great, Mark. Yeah. Good to be here.
I'm glad we're able to pull this off with three guests and Barbara and me. So we have five people on this show. So, the stars lined up for us for once. So let's start off with Judy. You're the mastermind behind AAPS. So when and where is your conference?
Conference this year is our 17th annual. It's October 7, 8, and 9th at the Island Resort and Convention Center. It's also a casino, but that's not part of us. In Harris, Michigan, which is 15 miles west of Escanaba on US 2 and Michigan's Upper Peninsula.
Okay. What is the website for people to check out, you know, all the speakers?
The
details. The
updated schedule, which keeps changing as months go by, but I've recently updated it at AAPS, that's Apple, Peter, Sam, then the word copper, aapscopper.com. And it'll be right there as one of the headliners, and you could just click on the place that takes us to registration. There's also meal packages. But the whole schedule is there for you to see, and a very brief description of their programs. We have 14 speakers throughout all of Friday from, when do we start programming? 10 o'clock until maybe 10:30, and then Saturday, 9 o'clock until about 10. And then Sunday, we close with our good friends, Ojibwa cousins, Bruce Hardwick and Dwayne Kinnert, who are world travelers and have carried the living fire of the Ojibwa people, to the world. So they'll be sharing some pretty interesting stories and about people that they have met. But that's our closing show. And there's a whole rest before that. How much do you want me to go into?
Okay. We have now we're starting to get into math on Nightlight, and that's not really encouraged. But there's 3 of the 14 speakers are here on.
Yeah,
the show tonight. So I think the audience would get a good taste of the variety of topics that will be discussed. If people are interested in, if they just say they drive to Harris, Michigan, they want to just take a little break after lunch. What are some places in the area that people can go to get more of a feel of Michigan's ancient copper mining and other prehistoric
sites? Not in that
sites?
Area. You'd have to head up to the Keweenaw.
Okay. How far is that away?
The Keweenaw Peninsula. How far from there? 90 miles, maybe?
A couple hours.
Okay.
Yeah,
a couple hours. The Keweenaw is part of the ancient Copper Range, and it's the Keweenaw or Ontonagon Range, and it was created millions and millions of years ago when this earth was formed and tectonic plates were pushing land masses up and gases forming, and somehow a magical thing happened and made those gases turn into pure copper as they cooled, and they were in those mountains. Then the glaciers came and went, and grinding down those high mountains and picking up copper and dragging it down as far as Northern Illinois and dragging it back. So this is why float copper, they called it float because it seemingly just floated there, but the glaciers picked them up and dropped them off. And how many millions of tons would there have been just lying on the surface that the ancients could have picked up? And you wonder, how do we know that ancients were here and picking up copper is a lot of what our conference is about. And this is part of the research that Jay has been a big part of.
Yeah. There's maybe it's the time to jump in. This AAPF was formed, AAPS, by from a fellow named Fred Ridholm, who was called Mr. Copper. He was the mayor of Marquette many times and a history teacher in high school there. And a very interesting guy and a mentor to most of us. And he was a wonderful guy that started this group. And the group has been very productive for a lot of researchers for now 17 years. What happened in Michigan was a very unusual geologic event, a very early lava flow over the Great Lakes area, you know, a billion years ago, a line in the area, and water percolated through the lava and deposited copper one atom at a time into the interstices of the lava bed. So there's a very enormous copper deposit with some silver in it under Lake Superior, and it was accessed where the lava bed was accessible, which is Isle Royal and the Keweenaw Peninsula. So the early electrifying of America was from mines in the 1800s that were that mined copper on top of the ancient copper mines that were found in these areas. It's a remarkable deposit on the earth. And so what's happened is that Fred Ridholm, who was Mr. Copper, got us all excited because he made it clear that these 10,000 pits, copper pits, were, nobody knew where the copper was clearly pulled out of these pits that are about 30, 40 feet deep in the Bronze Age, which is about 5,000, 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 years ago, but nobody knows where it went. And then Europe had a Bronze Age, and they had no idea where the copper came from. And we've just been connecting the two. And so it's an ocean sailing story and a cultural story of what happened in the Bronze Age.
Yep.
And what you're talking about there, Jay, is that roots needed to be there so that the copper could be transported. Well, there were no highways, of course, but the highways were the rivers and the waterways. And so part of our discovery is finding where ancient waterways were, and those can be found by topographic maps and Google Earth. And one of our speakers is talking about that, a different route between Lake Superior and Lake Michigan. So we know three now different ways that people could have taken the copper by canoe between the two lakes.
In fact, there's a petroglyph of a big ship, because in the Bronze Age, the sea levels were 60 feet higher, and large ships were able to come up the Mississippi and sail around the Great Lakes and down the Chicago River into the Mississippi without any rapids. So the Nipissing period with the deeper water was, we know, made the copper available to international shipping. We have a petroglyph of one that's carved at Copper Harbor. And if anybody wants to drive this area and look at the mines, you go up onto the Keweenaw Peninsula, and there's several mines that are open. There's a national park that consists of half a dozen mines. You can go into some of them, take tours, and you can go up to Copper Harbor. It's just a beautiful thing to do in the fall.
Doug, let me insert.
Sure.
The conference is in October, and this is Jill, but Lee and I drive up every October to this conference. And on the way, we see the leaves turning, and it is a spectacular drive anywhere from around Harris, Michigan. The leaves are turning at that time, and it's just a gorgeous time of year to be taking a road trip.
It is. We have a beautiful, beautiful country here.
Yes.
Okay. Let's cover, I think we got the listeners' attention with all the copper stuff. I don't want to forget about Jill's interesting presentations. Let's spend a little bit of time learning about the prehistoric horses, and we can come back to all this transatlantic crossings, the north and south route across the Atlantic and going back. But Jill, let's look at these, your interest in prehistoric horses.
Okay.
You are looking at the west coast of America, in the western portion of Canada, as a route for the horses coming to America. So where are they originating, and where do we find the evidence of America's prehistoric horses?
Well, in the last 5 years or so, there's been a big change in attitude about prehistoric horses. I'm saying prehistoric, I mean pre-Columbian horses.
Okay.
Now, prehistoric horses have always been, it's been accepted that we had here in North America very small animals that were related to the horse or the ancestor of the horse that didn't have hoofs, they had toes, and they were about as small as a dog. So that is all has always been accepted. But as far as full-size horses that men can ride, there's been a lot of controversy up until the last 5 years when the indigenous Americans started making their voices heard. And I think this has happened in many areas, but in the area of horses, they've begun to kind of give some pushback on the idea that the Spanish brought the horses to North America. Part of the pushback comes from the idea that Europeans like to take claim of for many benefits that are present here in the North American continent. And the American Indians claim they've always had horses, and many of the tribes have the horse spirit and stories of the horse in their legends, and they have petroglyphs. There are many petroglyphs, which I'm going to not many. I'd say about 10 petroglyphs of men riding horses sprinkled around through the continent, and I'm going to show those in my presentation. And there are several doctoral theses that have been done on where the horses came from. And a lot of them, of course, like you said, Mark, they come across into Canada and into Alaska, what is now Alaska and Canada, across the Siberian strait there. I forget what they call it now. The land bridge.
The Bering Strait?
From Russia. Bering Strait, yes. The land bridge from Russia over to the North American continent, which was, pretty solid at one time. And the Siberias always had these ponies, which the Mongols rode. The DNA of the American Mustang, which is a small, tough little horse, has been traced back to Siberia. So either they came across the Bering Straits on the land bridge, or they were brought across. Now, there has been controversy about how men came across from Russia into North America, but a lot of people have begun to realize that boats were not something that people shunned. If you could see some land and you had a boat, probably you took your boat over to that land. And there is a place, even today, in the Bering Sea, where you can see Russia from Alaska. And, of course, there were always people who would go back and forth. And not only that, but they found evidence of footprints on islands outside of North America, in the upper northwest, footprints that are fossilized into stone of humans, adults mm-hmm. and children, which meant that there were people here. And, of course, if there were people, they came on boats. This was on an island. And if they had boats, they brought their produce, and they brought their animals, and probably they brought their horses, because their horses were necessary, not just as draft animals, but as transportation. And if you ever had a horse, and I'm a horse person, if you ever had a horse, walking is just no fun. If you can ride, you'll ride, because it's so much faster and so much more fun. So probably horses came over along with men. Now, there are also other sources, and I have it straight from Laura Nicholas's mouth that the Chinese brought horses over in, 1433 or something like that. I don't have the date with me right now, but the Chinese came over in ships. Lots of Chinese came over and uh-huh. brought their horses. There's other arguments, too, against just the Spanish introducing horses. You can look at the horses in the Northwest and know that they're not Spanish riding horses. They're mm-hmm. small and scrubby and tough, and they have spots on them. Spanish riding horses were all one color. You know, they were brown or black or white or palomino or something. And they didn't have pinto spots. They didn't have Appaloosa spots. But by golly, look at the Siberian ponies, and they had spots on them. And you look at the horses running in the wild, and they have spots as well as being full color. So there's been a real mixture since the 1700s when the Spanish brought their horses over.
Joe, has anybody done any DNA testing on the lines, the family lines, or the genetics of these horses and their source, where they came from?
Yes, like I said, the DNA of the horses, the Northwest ponies, are related to the Siberian ponies.
Mm-hmm.
They have the Siberian DNA in them.
Okay, Jill, so when you're talking about the Northwest ponies, you know, we're kind of looking at something like the Shetland pony size versus, the Clydesdales.
Absolutely. You know, but
it was a big difference.
Yes, there is a difference. Now, they don't look like Shetlands. Shetlands come from, I believe, Ireland or something.
Mm-hmm.
But these ponies, you might say they're ponies. They're actually a small horse. And lots of them have curly hair. A lot of them have long manes that go to the ground. I mean, the manes do, not just the tails. They have very odd features that no European horse has. You know, they just don't look at all like it. They're small horses. They're very tough and scrubby, and they survive in almost any environment. You know, up north, it's very cold. And in the winter, the horses dig down under the snow. I mean, their hoofs are made perfectly for this. They can cut through the ice and the snow and find grass underneath or other living plants and stuff that they can eat. So these horses can survive. They're tough little things, and they're not wild that you couldn't take them and train them, you know, and actually ride them. They're pretty nice little beings, you know. You're going to get some horses that are wild and just untamable, but not these ponies. These ponies are pretty easily tamed and easily ridden. But the American Indians, the indigenous people, I should say, of North America, both in Canada and down in the United States, as well as in Alaska, have ridden these horses for centuries. And the American Indians certainly adopted them and used them as war horses, as draft horses. They used them for milk. I mean, a horse is a very valuable creature if you can tame it.
I can contribute something here. We have a researcher in our group that you'll hear it, yet you can meet at AAPS meeting, named Lon Krieger. And he is writing a book about the farm beds in the Great Lakes states, Michigan and Minnesota, and Minnesota. And he's documenting the size of the ancient farm beds. You know, there were a lot of miners to feed thousands of people. The farm beds are astonishingly big. And he claims they couldn't have done it without a horse. So he's also researching the horse, and it will be in his book. I'm supposed to be editing his farm bed book once he gets it further along. But at any rate, so this subject is being worked on by several people. Now, Jill is a very skilled artist, and is helping with dioramas on a museum exhibit we're developing on the Michigan copper trade, which we hope to put up as an exhibit somewhere while some of us are still alive. So it's kind of a race against time for some of us, but we're working on these things. Now, as a group, we've made a lot of discoveries about the copper trade. There are a number of harbors around the Great Lakes that were used when the water levels were higher around the on the near the Keweenaw at the private club has a harbor on it there, and the Copper and Beaver Island has newly discovered harbor on it, and the ship petroglyphs. There's a lighthouse been found at Chandelier Island down off of the mouth of the Mississippi. There were just lots of fleets of boats involved in this. And we found digital records that we can read and so on. There's just a lot of discoveries we've been making that we can't cover in a half-hour discussion on the radio. But I can tell you that our group has discovered a lot of things and we're building a case. Now, there are problems that we've had. One of them is that archaeologists don't generally go sailing. Most of them are not mariners, and that's been quite a problem. I have found several that actually have been involved with a lot of sailing, and they're doing a lot of good work, but most of them are not don't understand sailing well enough. But the major difficulty that we've had is the time depth. People just don't get it. It's very hard. It's simple to say, but hard to understand. The United States, started with colonies for about 200 years, and it's been a republic for the last 200, so 400 years or so. But we're talking this copper trade. We're talking ships from overseas and around the world, visiting North America 4,000 years ago. That's 10 times as long as the United States and the colonies they put together. The depth of time is difficult to comprehend. That, in fact, all these shopping centers we've built from coast to coast, all those big cities that have been built in the United States, all the airports, all these things are very recent compared to the thousands of years that people were traipsing all over North America. That we're able to document this stuff, and it's very hard to wrap your head around the depth of time to which people from around the world were traipsing around North America. And we can document this. It's just going to take some time to do it. Now, another problem is that professionals we have trouble with are archaeologists. And archaeology is a social science. It's located in universities under in the social science department, not as a real hard science. Okay, so what is correct in archaeology depends on the opinion of the department chairman, and in many cases, those sort of people have made decisions and pronouncements that are made without even having seen the evidence. It's just astonishing the trouble we're having. We've got archaeologists who won't even look at evidence. They won't even meet with us on some issues. And I've been rejected from I was going to give millions of dollars to a museum. New museum that's being built, and then they hired a new archaeologist, and I've been turned away because they wouldn't put much stones in there that were carved 4,000 years ago. They're considered to be impossible. They got so excited about a 1,700-year-old canoe, which is just historic time. It's historic time. They don't understand the depth of time. The professionals don't understand. We've published in the magazines. I've been in the magazine 35 times, published 3 books. I've never had an email or a request from an archaeologist to look at any of the evidence that I have presented. I have 30 bronze axes I can read, their stories in the digitally, and no one has ever called or asked or emailed me to see one of these. No graduate students, no professors, no nothing. So we're up against a difficult time trying to convince a profession that's a social science. We'd like to make it a factual science so that facts would matter and artifacts would matter. And it's a uphill struggle for us. But I think that we're going to be turning the corner because we've got some new discoveries coming down the road that are going to turn, I hope, going to turn this around while we're still alive, you know. I mean, if those of us that are doing the research work die, this may die away without people even being found. But we're working on it. We think we can make progress and turn this whole situation around so that the discoveries that this group has been finding over the years become recognized, and that this very old prehistoric history of North America becomes appreciated. And the public is pretty receptive to it, but the professions are not.
Well, if they can make a museum about the Ark here in Kentucky, they certainly could make a museum about history that is not, you know, about the same time as the Ark was here.
Mm-hmm.
Somewhere else.
Excuse me. Jay, you'd mentioned water levels having been maybe 50 feet higher in the Great Lakes, but there were times when it was lower than the levels of today because there have been discoveries of piers and maybe pyramids, other markers way in the water, and, of course, in the oceans, too. And this is what you'd mentioned, Chandelier Islands off of Louisiana. And all over the Philippines, wherever there's islands. Those maybe had been joined at some point, but there's structures under there. There's cities, there's civilizations long ago when the ocean was maybe 40, 50 feet lower.
And,
around the Great Lakes. People living around the Great Lakes know the water goes up and down all the time.
Yes.
It has. It has been much lower and has been much higher. And it's not consistent. Sometimes it's the North Shores because of the the ice melting off. Sometimes it's the South Shores are different. So the different shores are different elevations. You can see beach lines at different elevations around the lakes. What I'm talking about was the Nipissing period, which was 3000 BC, which has been very well documented by Jim Schertz, this professor at the surveying
University of Wisconsin.
Who's done a lot of work on this, and the Nipissing was a long period of high water. There are certainly low water periods and higher water periods also. It's true.
Well,
I just had a quick a point to make. Jill, you were talking about some of these hoof prints have been found in
not hoof prints, but human prints.
Okay,
footprints.
But it's almost like the extreme temperatures that have exposed these ancient dinosaur tracks in creek beds.
Mm-hmm.
Did you see that?
And also human footprints in Utah.
Right beside the dinosaur prints. So dinosaurs and man walk together.
Yeah,
walking together, okay.
Well, at least walking on the same path.
Right. Not hand in hand.
No, I don't think so.
Go ahead, Judy.
In other words, they lived around the same period, and it is certainly true that humans lived at the same time as mammoths. And that's something that I'm going to address in my book. I'm writing a book on ancient prehistory, actually prehistory. And when mammoths and humans existed side by side, and possibly mammoths were used to lift heavy stones or heavy objects, just like elephants are used today.
Mm-hmm.
You know what it always comes to at every conference, that we feel that all of the evidence is brought forward, all of the evidence of people coming from many times, from many, many places, and they came here, the evidence is sometimes they took things, they took copper, they took whatever resources were of value to them in their culture back home. Some stayed and mingled and left their, they became families, and others came and just left their DNA. And these markers are found in Native Americans all across the country. You might find Mediterranean and Hebrew markers, among the southern East Coast natives. You can find Chinese markers on the Northwest, and you can find...
Like the Macintosh stone.
Yeah, the Macintosh. We don't know. We're still trying to decipher that. And then, of course, you've got many, many Norse influences of words that are sounding the same and the same meanings across many of the northern Algonquin nations, that there's just so much evidence that the Norse, Swedes, Norwegians, Danes, they were here long ago. And then the Mandan Indians, that as a tribe, they're gone now, but there's still DNA evidence that they were here. And, of course, other artifacts. It always brings us to the people.
Go ahead. Selfish language.
Say that again, Jill.
And the Mandan supposedly spoke a Celtic language.
Oh, and their little boats were Celtic. What are they called,
they
Jay?
Those little round boats. Bull boats.
That's it.
They were just hides stretched on a dome of
And that came from the British Isles.
Wooden frame.
Yeah.
And
so it always comes down to it's a small world. We have always traveled and interacted, shared, stole, blended. And we're all mongrels. We're all really part of one big family, which is we feel that at conference. We have many people of different backgrounds, different political and religious beliefs, and we all get along. The foundation which Fred Reedholm set for us was lay all the pieces on the table and see how they fit. Don't throw anything away. Don't disparage the speaker. You don't have to agree. If we all agreed, we'd never learn anything. So we all play nicely together, and one fellow last year, and he's not the first, he came for the first time, he and his wife, and he was just gushing at the end. He says, "This is just like family. I feel so good here."
Yes, I must say that everyone is polite to everybody else. Even if they don't agree, that you don't hear anybody arguing or fighting or anything. They're all curious. Everyone is curious to find out what someone else has to say and how it might relate to what they have and what they've brought.
And that's another of the coolest things is when we bring people together. You know, I might talk to somebody on the phone or you might, and they're interested in such and such, and you say, oh, you need to meet this person. They're studying that too. And wonderful things have come from that, joint discoveries and expeditions and books written and just greater discovery because people have found one another in this network, which is very valuable.
I've learned a lot by going to this for the past 17 years. But I'd encourage any listeners that find this subject to be interesting to come. There's a lot of room for people, subject they're interested in, and research it and present their work and just help us, you know, because it's a big subject. This is a big area of research and in prehistory of the continent. And there's a lot of room for you if you're a listener that's interested.
Well, we have people who have found a rock. You mentioned the McIntosh Stone. That was just a little rock found in the Keweenaw. And that man who found it when he was a high school kid, he had his 30 minutes of fame, if you want to call it. He was just an amateur. But his space was just as important as Michael Cremo or any of other famous people who have come to talk with our group. And we say it's a sharing. Not a show, because we don't pay our speakers, which still stuns me that we get so much talent and experience there that these people are willing to come at their own expense. They don't pay registration, of course, but to be able to do that because they realize they get as much as they give.
And we do have professionals that come.
Absolutely,
I would say Scott Walter is a professional, and we have, Jim and and
lots of people
many
are professional.
People are professional. Yeah,
yeah, they're professional at a whole lot of different things, which is useful to us actually. So if you're a listener that's got a particular kind of a skill, whether it's ground radar, studies,
flying a drone,
whatever it might be, just come and contribute. We'd like to see you.
Yeah, flying a drone. Like it, Mark, you mentioned that. That's really important these days.
It's becoming ubiquitous, and I'm sure Jay is familiar with a lot of the drone footage being taken over America's Stonehenge. Dennis is probably listening now, but he sent me numerous photos of some of the what the drones are revealing, and the alignments. It's being used so heavily right now in all kinds of archaeological sites. It's giving us a totally new perspective.
The ground penetrating radar is non-invasive.
LIDAR.
It doesn't, and then there's LIDAR, which shows a map without the trees, but the ground penetrating radar doesn't wreck anything. You just take it across and see a lot of things that would have had to have been dug out previously in order to find
post, where post holes were located.
And in Kentucky, we have a group of really interesting people who are very curious about what's gone on in Kentucky, which is kind of central United States, that is east central. And evidently, there was quite a lot of activity in this area in prehistoric times. And we have a drone person that has done drone work for us over some mountaintops, and their drones have even encountered some kind of microwaves or magnets or something, and have, which has drained their batteries, and they just barely got their drones back. So there are interesting things here that we are going to try to investigate. And also, we use LIDAR and drones in England, in Wales. We actually paid somebody to go and do work over what we think was King Arthur's Camelot. There's a place in Wales called Carmelon, and we paid someone to do LIDAR work, and sure enough, on a high hill, the highest point in that part of Wales, there is a circular, like a tower, with other buildings that is showing up in the fields on that tall mountain, on that tall plain. So it could have been a castle.
Yes, very interesting. Now, you talked about professionals or non-professionals. Some of our amateurs are professional amateurs because they've done so much travel and discovery for so many years. Jay is among them, and Lee Pennington, your sweetie pie, and his wife before you. And and he's just made so many important discoveries and filmed them, and has... It's always so interesting. Now, he's got a very broad knowledge, and I often refer people to him. And we do have, let me see, another professional from Egypt coming this time. We've got three people talking about pyramids, and pyramids aren't just in Egypt. They're all over the world. So we have Maher Haggag from Egypt, and then we have David Rush of Ohio, who is also talking about who built the pyramids. He's got his angle of research. And Angela Michael, who is a new speaker, both of them, David Rush and Angela Michael. Now, Angela has been researching for, 30 years and using Google Earth and putting a lot of things together. And she has met with a lot of people. Have you met her yet, Jay?
I don't think I've met him yet, no.
No, Angela, Angela Michael.
I like
her. Yeah. So she has found pyramids.
I'm helping to bring Maher because he's a teacher of ancient Egyptian, the reading of ancient Egyptian, and it's relevant to the artifacts, some of the artifacts we've been finding. So we're trying to make
in
him
North America.
Trying to get him to be part of our team and our so that we can develop our depth and of expertise among our people, you know.
Sure, and we have Egyptian evidences here too, found in caves, and look at all the place names that are Egyptian names, Cairo, and I can't even think of the other ones now, but there's a number of
Memphis.
Yep, Memphis.
We're working on that.
In southern Illinois called Little Egypt.
Yes.
Yeah, that's what he's, we'd like his take on a lot of this stuff, so it's going to be interesting to get to know him.
So place names are important.
What's that?
Okay.
I said place names are important, but if you know this Egyptian fellow, you might snag him for next year, Jay.
What? He's coming this year.
Oh, that's the one you're talking about. Okay.
Yeah.
I thought you gave me another name. I heard another name.
Maher.
Yeah, Pat White and Jay are sponsoring him, bless your hearts.
Yeah, well, we need his help.
Jay, you need to tell us some of the things that you're working on, because Jay has presented and has done articles for many, many years in many subjects. And
in Ancient American Magazine.
In Ancient American Magazine. And he's done studies on both in Europe and in other areas. So he has a lot of stuff, and he's working on some particular projects right now, too. Things that I'm helping him with, in that I'm doing these large tableaus, you might say, of prehistoric towns and copper smelting and mining. Area.
Will you bring some pictures with you so we can see?
Sure.
If you want to show those, Jill, why don't you can bring pictures of them and show them.
Yeah, I'll give you a table.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that'd be good.
I've only done two, but because they take so long.
Yeah, there might be a third coming. What's that?
They're extremely, I've only done two, but they take so long. They're extremely detailed.
Are they very large, or do you do them smaller and then going to have them projected larger on the...
We could have them projected larger because they're supposed to be, like, extremely large.
Mm-hmm.
And I do them at 600 DPI so that they can be...
Enlarged.
They're detailed at... when they're enlarged.
I'm getting them printed here in Seattle at 4 foot by 6 foot. To be dioramas in the museum exhibit.
Great.
If you can show them, just add them to your talk and show them to the conference, that'd be fine. That's fine with me. They're, I'm not proprietary about them. I mean, people can use them.
Great.
So,
okay.
For other things. So,
Well, one thing always leads to another when we're talking about any subject, and it can link to this and then that and then that. It's like finding a standing stone that seems significant. It's pointing to something. If you see one, a marker stone, it's pointing to another stone, and they mean something.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, you get a lot of ideas coming to this conference, and I recommend the listeners come to the AAPS in Escanaba and the Island Resort, and you can just get an earful of a lot of different subjects, and you might find something that's of particular interest to you. The other thing is you should subscribe to Ancient American if you don't get it. It's you can Google ancientamerican.com or Ancient American is a magazine, and
be getting that. Every person that comes to conference and should be getting that magazine. I think they do.
Yes, I think so. It was printing 16,000 for a while. I don't know what he's doing right now. But I certainly recommend that if his listeners find anything interesting in this brief presentation tonight, that you either come to the conference or at least subscribe to Ancient American Magazine for $35 or something, you'll find it just fascinating. So
we also have an AAPS page or group on Facebook, and there's a wonderful interchange of ideas there from all over the world. We have, gee whiz, our members are probably about 7,000 now, which is very nice, and people will... Sometimes they'll bring things that people will say it's just a rock, but we have trained them not to say nasties to people who have just a rock. But they're interested and they're out there looking. And they're trying to. They see anomalies, and sometimes it's natural things, and other times maybe they'll find something wonderful. But there's some really great sharing there, and on Facebook we have to spell out the whole name: Ancient Artifact Preservation Society. And you will get there and join and see what's going on. And if you have something to share, you have a little find that's curious to you, show it. And if you find something cool on the Internet, share that. It's been a very nice group.
Yeah. Judy, speaking of finds, in a couple of the... chapters that Jay has in his the copper trade, he talks about the Moog collection and how they got Jay interested in these axes and deciphering them. So Jay, could you tell us a little bit about story and how it led you into analyzing the dots and rows on the axe heads?
Yeah, I could just, there's not much time left, but let me just say that a Dr. Moog, the physician in southwest Germany, collected what are called decorated axes during his lifetime. He died a long time ago. And it was found, I guess there's a museum in his neighborhood there which has some of his stuff, but they found a box under his house that was in the mud. Yeah, World War One was fought over his house, and World War Two was fought there. And so the provenance of some of this stuff is, from a box in the mud under his house. And I've been able to buy about 30 of these decorated axes. I've been in most of the museums in Europe, everywhere but Berlin, and I have never seen one of these in a museum. I have 30 of them. They record information digitally, and I can read where they sailed and where their colonies were and so on. It's a remarkable collection. I was going to give them all to the Historical Society, but... they don't want to show them, so here goes a priceless set of stuff. I'm going to put it in a museum somewhere else. But they're just remarkable. They're just
What you have shown to us, whether it be on stone or bronze or an axe or with these designs, they just look like pretty designs until you get somebody smart like you to say that, no, those aren't designs. They're telling us something. They're telling us lengths of time and space and nautical miles and islands. And
locations.
Locations, yes.
Yeah.
People
didn't
put things on stones willy-nilly. They meant something.
It took a long time for people to be able to put what was said in the air down on paper. Language is a very recent thing. Okay, and so these, for thousands of years, people were crawling all over North America, and there's no digital records. There's no written records, and so historians say it's all baloney, we'll never know, and that's all wrong, because we can now read on the bronze, recorded in bronze, we can read the latitudes of where they were sailing and so on, and you can read all these latitudes of 39 and 38. 38 numbers, 38 dots, and 39 dots. That's all about the Azores Islands. And when you go there, there's on Mount Pico, there's pyramids there on the waterfront. And there's another axe with a feather dancer drawn on it. And the prehistory is starting to be understood a little, but not by the archaeologists yet, because none of them are called to look at any one of these 30 axes. I think they're priceless records
they
from
are.
The Bronze Age, and I'm going to do something with them. I can't just have them go to have my sister give them to a garage sale. I've got to exhibit them somewhere. A lot
yeah,
of them
write,
have been...
A, write a book about them, Jay. I mean, just...
Yeah,
are
well,
you
a bunch
the,
of them, a bunch
are,
of them are in my book.
Are you bringing them to the conference?
The copper trade. Well, I brought one to the conference, and the flight attendant on the airplane said they were a weapon and almost took one away from me.
Oh, no.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, I can't travel with them, but I was going to give the
can
museum all
them
of them.
In your bag.
I think they're
you
priceless,
can put
them
in,
you know. But academics don't get it. Academics don't get them yet. I'm going to ship all this stuff back and build a museum. So that's down the road.
Okay.
We're working on it. Jill and I are working on a museum. And I'm working with some other people, too. So
you have not talked about your presentation, Jay, for conference.
Yeah. Well, at this conference, I'm going to talk about the end of the Bronze Age at 1200 B.C. and what that led to, what caused it, what led to, and where it was, and it's... And the Olmecs that observed it and carved relics about it. So, anyway, that's just a special little subject that I've been studying for years, and I just wanted to kind of get it off my plate and for people to understand what it's about. But, all my work on the copper trade is in the book, so I think I've already written down most of that. But it's been a very interesting experience to be involved with AAPF. I've learned a lot over the years. I've contributed a lot also, met a lot of interesting people. These people are my friends. Judy's friends put a lot of love around. It's a very rewarding thing to go to.
Yeah. And also, you learn a lot about prehistoric times and maybe even your own ancestors and why they came over, and also, I have an article that was published in Ancient America. It was called The Maps That Columbus Used, and it is now available on academia.edu. It's called The Maps That Columbus Used, but it's in two parts. The first part talks about all of the people that came to North America, to the North American continent, I should say, and the South American continent too, partly, from Europe, from Asia, and from all around the world. And there were many, many civilizations. Africa was one of the big civilizations that came to South America. And they had a great influence in South America at one time, but that was a prehistoric time. And they left these huge heads, which were unearthed, in the last century. And they're obviously African heads. And it had to do with the climate change in Africa. Africa used to be all jungle, and then this great desert arrived, because of the climate, and became the Sahara Desert. Well,
and there used to be cities there. There are maps that show cities.
Yes, and all those people had to go somewhere. There were thousands of people, and a lot of them came to South America. Well, that's just one influx of immigrants into these two continents. And there were other people from the Asia, from China, from the Orient, from the Philippines. They've recently shown that the DNA of many American Indians is Filipino, which is shocking to many people, but it stands to reason. The Filipinos were great sailors in their day.
And they could cross the sea outrigger canoe? Is that the right name for it, Jay?
They
could travel great distances. And they could build them very,
very
big and carry a lot of gear with them, and they were very seaworthy.
Absolutely.
We're having a lot of problems with politics. You can't get a grant to do archaeology in the Azores because these Portuguese are very defensive about their possession of the Azores, and if somebody else discovered it, they worried that they might lose their possession. And the Spanish is very The Spanish are producing this Columbus thing, which he was the last guy to get here. But they've been trying to justify their taking over of Central and South America, enslaving the people, which they did. They made slaves of all the locals because they became with the property when the property was given to conquistadors. So they enslaved the people, millions of deaths due to the Spanish. And they're trying to justify all this, that they discovered the place, which is just total baloney. The problem is the Smithsonian bought it and has been pushing it, and it's been very hard for us to counter archaeologists that are trained in the Smithsonian mantra that Columbus was first.
Yeah,
it's
manifest
just been nasty.
Destiny.
It's been nasty. But I think we're going to make progress because we're just getting so many pieces, so much evidence, and there's just a wave that's starting to build here on this.
Early times of archaeology with the Smithsonian and Powell and everything, that if anybody spoke or published anything about Native Americans having a written language, they would lose their careers. And so they had to keep them stupid. And it was, if they're savages, then it's all right to overtake them and destroy them or make slaves or whatever they wanted with them. But if they were intelligent people with a written language, it's not so easy to do. So nobody could say that it was true that these people here had intelligence and skills and communication methods.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're finding
Judy's
gotten close to some of the Indians, and so is Jim Schertz, who is a little bit of an Indian, I guess. And we're getting some knowledge from Indians that they haven't been able to tell the white people.
Yeah. Yes. Well, we've been building trust.
A lot of this is coming out. Yeah.
At our conference, which is lovely, we've made friends with the Potawatomi and the Ojibwa, Ho-Chunk, and maybe some others that have come in, and they realize that this is a safe place. And this is what speakers for years, we've been doing this more almost 30 years, but only officially for 17, actually 18 because we skipped a year of a conference, but that people can feel safe speaking what they have to say where they have been rejected and ostracized by the professionals elsewhere, and finally they come here and they just about cry, and some have, with relief that they find people who will listen to them and not call them fools. And it's happened many times. You've seen it, you kids, you, Jay and Jill.
Yeah. It was a lot of fun. You know, one of the Potawatomi chiefs named me Iskide Mi'igan. Gave me an Indian name at the last conference.
Oh, did he?
And put me into the
Wolf
Clan.
Yeah, was that Earl Meshugad?
Yeah.
Well, Ken Meshugad is the chief.
They're calling me an educator in the Wolf Clan. They put Wayne in the Bear Clan, remember that? It was fun.
Yes, that was terrific.
So you never know quite what you're going to get at this conference, but, you know, it's always something. I've never been disappointed.
Good.
Well, part of my paper is going to be some of the American Indians who have recently done research that has been accepted by the Intelligentsia, the university, you might say, community. And I'm going to reveal some of these people who are indigenous Americans who have done research on their own tribes and their own peoples and come up with some fabulous stories that just totally counteract what has been said by European descendants. And it's very exciting what's happening right now.
They have been allowed to find out.
A lot of young people are beginning to accept a broader view of our history.
Yes. Well, the natives for so long were stifled in their education and wanted the Americans tried to just teach the Indian right out of them. And this group, our friends there, they're trying to get the Indian culture, their language, their ways back to the young people. And that's only happening now, you know, after all this time. And they're finally realizing that they have much to be proud of and much to learn, and it's okay. They're not being stifled anymore.
It's coming around.
Jill, are you finding that by looking at the legends and folklore that you're getting more of a truthful story, or maybe the story is being actually backed up by maybe some of the archaeological evidence, and like you know what was mentioned just a minute ago. Are they revealing more about themselves than what was in, just say, the settlers' journals?
Absolutely. There is so much more, Mark. You just have no idea how much more there was that was totally ignored. One of the Indian women that has done a doctoral dissertation and is now has a book out, has revealed that all of the tribes in the North American continent actually had like pacts between them and treaties between them where they used the whole continent as a system, an ecological system. Certain areas were used for game, certain areas were used for gardens, and certain areas were used for mining and precious metals and stones and shells. And of course, the habitation areas were everywhere, and the different tribes adapted to their local environment. But she claims that all of the American Indians existed peacefully, knowing that they could trade and get goods from one side of the continent to the other when they were needed, and that they could get game, food, precious metals, anything they needed could be found, and they had a whole system which was totally destroyed when the frontiersmen came in and started taking over these areas that had been preserved as sacred grounds, and they just started claiming the land and doing all kinds of things to it and just totally destroyed their system.
Right. The natives didn't have a sense of ownership. It belonged to everyone.
Yes, and they had a complete system that everybody knew about. But when the Europeans came in, they had no idea that there was already a system in place. Mm-hmm. They just willy-nilly trampled over all of the systems that were put in place and had been existing for centuries.
They could have learned so much, and some did, thank goodness.
Yes. Yes, some did. But in
the story is never ending. We're finding that we are more alike than we are different, and that there always have been exchanges of people of all kinds from all over the world. And we like to point them to the North America. And if we could point it to our copper, that's a bonus. It doesn't always, but we learn so much.
Mm-hmm. Well, another thing, Mark, that you asked about was in the legends. And the legends show that the people adapted to their environments. And the book that I'm writing, which is about 12,000 B.C., when the world was destroyed, everyone knew about it, and they went underground all over the world. People built tunnels under their cities.
Oh, 12,000?
Yes. 12,000 B.C.
Okay, that's way back.
And they went underground, and then the Younger Dryas occurred because they were aware that it was coming. And they built tunnels under, and now today you're finding tunnels under every major city. And people are familiar with the catacombs in Rome and with the Vietnamese tunnels, the Viet Cong tunnels, but no one knows who made them. Well, it was people that lived long ago. These were whole systems. These were whole cities that were built underground. And they're finding more and more and more of them in Russia and China and everywhere. But
and
anyway,
they have been used in many civilizations after those, some for not
many
very nice things.
Right.
Carl Henke is going to be talking about the Younger Dryas events and the science of dating and the trickery that has been used to confuse science. Didn't help our knowledge, but so he's going to be covering some of that.
Right, and the legends tell, the American Indian legends tell that their ancestors, the ones that we hear today, their ancestors came up from underground where they've been living.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And that was
okay,
our Adam and Eve, you might say.
Yeah, you hear that in the Kiva stories.
Yeah. The Kivas were, if anyone is unfamiliar with what a Kiva is, it's around kind of like a meeting hole, and it's kind of usually covered, like underground, sort of. They build mounds over them, and they it's kind of like going underground to meet, and it's a sacred, peaceful, holy place.
And safe.
Mm-hmm.
When Maria Wheatley's been a guest with us, she's spoken about the frog goos in the Orkney Islands that were used almost like a sensory deprivation tank.
Got me on that one.
Oh, yeah. And you also have that passage in the Book of Revelation about the people who live in the earth.
Ah.
So that's kind of weird. It's the Bible's going sci-fi on us on that passage. It's like, who are those people?
Yeah.
Have to look that up. I need to mention Bob Krepke, who has done a great deal for discovery on ancient Michigan copper. He has done three parts in a series called America's Greatest Industry. He had first wanted to call it Michigan's Greatest Industry, which is the copper mining. But he has done a lot of research from many sources, from naysayers as well as people like us who believe differently. But he's done a fabulous job. We might see his fourth episode of this series. He's not ready for this fall yet. But there is another one coming, and it's been shown on public television. And it can be found. Go ahead, Jay.
He was a filmmaker for Ford Motor Company for his whole life. So he's quite experienced in this stuff. Most of us are focused on Bronze Age, not going heebie-jeebie way back into the Ice Ages and before, although some people do. And there is interesting stuff in India underwater and all that. But we have, at AAPF, we've been sticking more to the copper story, which is a Bronze Age thing around 3000 BC down to around 1200 at the end of the Bronze Age. So,
well, there are even some
kind of
datings in Wisconsin 6000 years ago.
There's
in the
people
copper
have got some early
mining
dates on the copper here and there. So the question is what's the evidence? We always want to hear the evidence, you know, or
mm-hmm.
what people have. So,
yeah.
But at any rate,
people aren't just giving us theories. They're showing us the stuff, what they have found to come to their theory.
We want to see the evidence. That's right.
Yes.
Right.
So,
as far as the 12,000 date, I have done a lot of research probably over the last 10 years, and we all know of the cave, we all know of the tunnels, we all know of the, ancient, like, computers and stuff that have been found underground, and a piece of copper with a piece of coal maybe with a gear in it, you know, that
uh-huh.
is shocking because it had to have been there when the coal was formed, which would have been thousands of years ago. Things like that. So,
there's interesting books are called Uparts, out of place artifacts.
Yes.
They're fascinating, and it's hard to relate them to anything because the dates are hundreds of thousands out of place on some of them, and or maybe millions of years out of date. So they're maybe more alien than anything else. It's hard to know what some of these what the out of place artifacts are is difficult.
Well, what we're getting past is what I learned in grade school that came from a knuckle-dragging caveman and got smarter and more sophisticated as hundreds of years went by. But there are cultures that have come and gone. They have been very sophisticated and technologically smart and then had their civilization change, maybe a catastrophe, maybe a comet, maybe an ice age, and then they almost start all over again. And so we've been up and down, up and down. It's not an easy grade from stupid to smart.
Some of this stuff has been presented and discussed by speakers at the AAPS over the years. But it's hard to pull it all together and make sense out of everything at once.
Jay, one of the, we've been talking about some of these mysteries. Judy, that biblical passage is in Revelation 5:3.
I will look it up.
Just for the listeners, I'll read. But there was no one in heaven or on the earth or under the earth who was able to open the scroll and read it. Jay, since we've been talking about some of these mysteries, we've had guests like Lori Nicholas, it's in your book as well, where people are sailing into the Great Lakes and they're making their way down the Mississippi River.
Or the St. Lawrence.
They visit Cahokia. And there's all these waterways are very instrumental in navigating throughout the North American continent. And Jay, you're arguing that there are a couple places there at the where the Mississippi Delta empties into the Gulf of Mexico. There are a couple places that show ancient ruins. And I think last year Judy had George Gillet speaking. Was
George's
information...
very ill right now. He's he's not doing well.
Okay, well,
I'm sorry to hear that. He made some fairly major discoveries, in my opinion.
Yeah, he's made some over 50 years.
Is his research supporting yours, or is he going back earlier? But can we talk a little bit about that mystery of the Delta and what was going on there? And
Jay, tell him about the copper processing place now, which could very well link.
Well,
Poverty Point.
First of all, mystery. A mystery is something going on below your level of understanding. You know, some people get in a car and they turn the key and it's dark, and it's a mystery. Okay? That's just an example. So
something we don't understand.
It's something we don't understand. So what you try to do is study and learn a little more so that you begin to understand what's going on. Now, there's a Bruce Seth archaeologist. There's an archaeologist named Bruce Seth in Texas, who is my age, getting on. And he has an excellent report that I found at Poverty Point. There's a major site called Poverty Point on the that used to be on the Mississippi. Bruce Seth's report revealed that at the mouth of the Pearl River, where there's been a lot of flooding recently, actually it's the Pearl River has the biggest swamp in the United States. I thought the biggest was in Georgia, but I took a cruise on a jet boat through it, which you can do when you're down there, and there's a huge swamp. And, of course, it was full of trees, and those trees could have been floated down to the mouth of the Pearl River. And at the mouth of the Pearl River, the Bruce S. report shows carbon deposits that are 6 feet deep, multiple, and two different villages that are different from one another, two different cultures, not Indian cultures, but from the old world, one we think Minoan and one I think Beaker people. But at any rate,
which is an area of your expertise, the Beakers.
Mm-hmm. So these people were melting copper. It's not smelting. Smelting is a process of getting copper out of, you know, your green rocks and yellow rocks and like that.
But you've got pure copper, you don't need to smelt it.
Pure copper, you don't have to go to the high temperature and smelt it. It's just a matter of melting the copper out of the rocks from the Great Lakes. So they'd come down the river. Now, the river was not dammed by the Corps of Engineers like it is today. So sometimes you could paddle up the Mississippi, and sometimes it would be roaring down full of logs. But you'd watch the seasons. These people sailed up and down with copper in the bottom of their boats, and they'd land at this place that Jill has just painted in her diorama, and they would melt with big fires and carbon 6 feet deep and fires, and melt copper into hollowed out places in the ground, and make what are called oxide ingots. These are ingots, 60 pounds, over 50 or 60 pounds, that had ears on them so they could pick up the corners, okay? And that's how the copper was shipped to Europe, and it was sold by the Minoans all over Europe.
And there are pictures on walls in Egypt of oxides.
Yeah, the oxides was the, and the pharaohs would give, you know, so many hundred as a gift to another king and so on. It was the way copper was traded around in the old world by the Minoans and in northern Europe by the Beaker people. At any rate, the mouth of the Pearl River is where a lot of this happened. And it's a you take a little route up through a little waterway up through the bayous to get to the site. It now has an industrial site on it, but I got in there with a local archaeologist who was an employee of NASA. Now, just up the same waterway, NASA has a big installation, a big military installation, and barges go through there. The biggest ones are carrying oxygen and hydrogen in huge containers on barges, and those go up, and every piece of everything that has been shot into space by the Americans has been put on a test put on a test platform there, and has been tested at this site before it goes over to Canaveral and gets shot off. Okay, so this little waterway, all the copper that was shipped, that was melted and shipped to Europe for the Bronze Age, went down that little waterway, and all the things shot to space have gone up and down that waterway, the same little waterway. It's quite remarkable, and nobody's ever heard of it, but it's right there at the mouth of the Pearl River. It's quite amazing. So, and yes, big fleets of boats came from Europe over thousands of years. People don't understand. You know, I've been studying this 30 years. I mean, it's a drop in the bucket. I mean, this happened 4,000 years ago and 3,000 years ago, and many, many boats were docked on the salt domes off of Louisiana, and where there are underwater pottery being made that's now underwater, but the pottery probably was so that they had pots to put salt in, because that was such a valuable way to preserve food before the refrigerators. So the people sailing to Europe were sailing off with copper and with buffalo hides and drugs and salt in pottery in pots and pearls from the rivers in Tennessee, and it was an amazing trade across the Atlantic in the Bronze Age, and they have no written records, so the archaeologists think it didn't exist. And this is the fight. This is what we're up against.
Wow,
Jay, with the hieroglyphs that have the oxide copper ingots.
They also show the bun ingots. So men carrying the oxides, and another man carrying a tray full or a basket full of bun ingots. They look like a hamburger bun.
Some of them are copper, and some of them are tin when they're in thin bun form.
And how do you make bronze? If you get
to Egypt, look at the most important thing is to go into the Valley of the Kings, of course, and see those underground tombs. But the most beautiful tomb is Hatshepsut's, and the carvings are on the first floor level of Hatshepsut's tomb. You can see her ships and carvings and the copper ingots.
Well, it's important. Why is copper and tin important is because bronze is basically 90% copper and 10% tin. So the tin mines of England and the copper from the UP, Upper Peninsula of Michigan, they came together.
Yeah. Personally, I think a lot of the tin came from South America, but archaeology in South America hasn't gotten very far yet. But there are indications on petroglyphs that they were down in the Rio de la Plata, down in South America, and probably picking up tin there from the Andes.
But there was tin from England to Egypt and to the Hebrew nations and Phoenicians, so that there was tin trade back and forth from.
Yeah. Sure.
What Rio de la Plata means, right? It means the river of silver.
Well, that's what was up there with the whole mountain of it. Yeah.
Yeah. It looks like silver. Tin does.
Yeah. Huh. Well, you know, one of the conquistadors wrote that there was a pathway from the Silver Mountain all the way to the Atlantic coast that had all the vegetation cleared. So it was a clear pathway right down to the ocean. It was maintained clear by the natives because of the big trade going on. But, of course, when the conquistadors came, all that stuff just overgrown was gone, you know. But
so what was it used for horse travel?
I don't know. Trade to the Atlantic. To the Atlantic.
To carry the tin to the ocean, to the Atlantic.
But
not on a river, by land.
In Argentina.
By land.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's a lot in South America that hasn't been researched yet. There's reasons for it. But, you know, the Baker people tombs are in the Andes, in the Colombian Andes, at the top of the mountains, enormous tombs. The Baker people established the first, not only copper trade in Michigan, but also the first major culture in South America on the Magdalena River. So there's a lot to be done in South America.
Okay, Jay, we know from other guests we've had that the Beaker people came from continental Europe. They had interactions with the native English people that they kind of worked somewhat together on the building of Stonehenge, or some of the Beaker people were buried at Stonehenge. But you know, you do go on to argue that those, you know, the Beaker people are the people who were like the megalithic mariners who were coming to North and South America. You know, were they giant people?
Some of them were. Some of them are 8 feet tall. Yeah. And of course, they were huge. They weren't just tall. They were enormous people, some of them. And they became the elite of most of the civilizations where they landed, including the Hopewell people in the United States. But
size did matter.
Yeah, that's right. But the confusion on this just goes and goes and goes. The Smithsonian magazine just had an article. One of the major magazines just had an article about Stonehenge, and claimed it was built by the people before the Beaker people, and the Beaker people came along just afterward. No, they got it completely wrong. The evidence was wrong. It was in the article. And it was created by the Beaker people, not by their predecessors. It's amazing that this major article, a major magazine, got the whole thing backwards. It's just astonishing. But that's
now, Jay, what's your interpretation of the reason that they built Stonehenge? Was it about navigation? Was it about spiritual stuff? What do you think?
I'm getting that it's past 8:30. How late does this show go? Does anybody know?
We're about 20 more minutes.
Going to 9 o'clock. Okay.
Or midnight here.
Yeah. Okay.
11 o'clock here.
So, well, thanks for clarifying that a little bit. We've done a lot of work on Stonehenge many years ago. It's in our first book. Our first book on how the Sun God got to America is about the petroglyphs in Europe. And the second book on rocks and rows is about the long rows of stones in Karnak and other places in Europe and other sites. And the copper trade is just about the American story, basically. So to answer your question, what was Stonehenge about? If you look at our, you're not going to believe it, but maybe I'll say it anyhow. You look at our book for the evidence. That's how the sun god reached America. Looking at the site mathematically, which is what we do. My partner at the time was a PhD in the physical chemistry and counted everything, and so we studied the thing the site mathematically. And the first part of it was built at 3000 BC, and then the rest of it was the big stones came in there, you know, 1,000 years later. It's got a long history of development. What we think is that when the people learned what was on the backside of the earth, it caused an enormous change in thinking, and that they spent the next 1,000 years building round stone circles, 1,000 stone circles, and they built these great big round circles in Costa Rica and around that were teaching sailing. They just couldn't believe that there was a whole continent full of riches over on the other side of the world. They had no idea what was back there. They had a major effort to find what was on the backside of the earth, and when they did, it was a big deal. And we think that Stonehenge was built to celebrate their discovery of America. But you're not going to be able to believe that until you study it.
Celebrate. But then there are all those celestial alignments and all, and it seems
That's
logical
correct.
That it would be about teaching navigation by the stars.
They couldn't say have sailed the world without understanding the cross-quarter days and so on. So, yes, there's all these sites. I just wrote an article in the current Ancient America magazine about the site of Callanish on the Isle of Lewis. And again, I could read it mathematically, and it was about a celebration of the sun god and their successful voyage from the America back through their colony in the Azores at 38 degrees north, and they built a monument to thank the sun god that they reached home after many years of sailing with all the riches that they came back with. It's amazing stories. The heroes, the sailing heroes, and the courage of early man is not recognized and not really understood. The depths of the sailing, the talent of these people, and what they accomplished is a story.
What sailors today could accomplish what they did by the stars?
They had advantages that sailors today don't have. They were, the seas had not been commercially fished. They were full of food, and the weather was warmer. We know the weather was warmer during this Bronze Age. There's a number of, and their weather, their equipment, people that want to sail across the Atlantic now, sometimes they just go and get these seal skin clothing and stuff that the old timers had. Their clothing was good. Their food was excellent. The sea was full of food. The climate was warmer. Yeah, they were sailing the seas, and they were very good at it. And they could not record their verbal expressions, their language, but they recorded their stories digitally, and I'm able to read those now on these bronze axes. It's quite remarkable. Supposedly, the latitudes were not known till 500 AD. Academically, that's what they say, but we can see at the site of Barnenez on the north coast of France that they were recording latitudes at 3800 BC is the date of that monument. So they knew.
Yep. They were smart. They weren't knuckle draggers.
They could find their way. They found their way around. They found the other side of the earth.
Yep.
It was a very exciting thing.
You know, even today, they honor those early sailors, and the whole area, the French Polynesia, and those thousands of islands that are out in the middle of the Pacific, just on or below the equator, thousands of islands there. Those people sailed from New Zealand and Australia and the Philippines, and they sailed out knowing the stars and the way the light shone through different kinds of crystals and so forth. they could figure out where they were going. And
the crystal
even today,
liking,
and even today, today
they memorize.
They
even
do
today,
that.
They
use
they
those,
built a,
and
they built
have,
one of those sailboats in Hawaii and sailed it around the world.
And
they
sailed
the
double hull ship.
Mm-hmm.
Using the old technology, and they had
and
no modern instruments on the ship at all. They just kept on.
They
just kept on using the old ways, and they could sail to wherever they wanted to.
They knew which stars rose above the horizon at dusk, for example.
Yes.
They'd have those all memorized, and so they'd be able to tell in the dark which stars had risen and when. You know. They were quite skilled.
Yes.
Captain Cook was amazed by the skills of these people.
Uh-huh.
You know,
because
he put
he
them
was
on
using
boat
instruments.
And then they killed him.
Some of them showed Captain Cook where the islands were.
Yep.
We've been speaking of the larger AAPS conference, but you and Lee do have many conferences at your house for the Ancient Kentucky group. Do you have coming up? What subjects? It seems like you've had a number of King Arthur-related presentations. Can you tell us a little bit about those, going on?
Well, our founder, the founder of the Ancient Kentucky, and Kentucky is spelled K-E-N-T-U-C-K-E, Kentucky, the old-fashioned spelling. The founder was very interested in Prince Madoc, M-A-D-D-O-C. Uh-huh. And Prince Madoc led him to King Arthur. Now, King Arthur was Prince Madoc's brother. So evidently Prince Madoc landed and came to Kentucky, and perhaps King Arthur came here, and he might even have been killed here in Kentucky. So we have conferences on things like that, and there are sites in Kentucky up in the hills and in the what they call the hills and the hollers of areas which have not been discovered but have ancient buildings on them. And the Ohio River has forts ever so often, like every, 20 miles or something. It has forts up and down the Ohio River, which perhaps the Romans have built. And we have someone named Rick Osman who comes over from Illinois, and he talks about the Roman forts, and he's written several books, I think. The Clan of Cave, not the Clan, but the Golden...
The Graves of the Golden Bear.
Grave of the Golden Bear, yes. And he writes about the Romans who came and went down the Ohio and built their forts. And we have... We have all kinds of very interesting artifacts here with lots of Roman coins having been lost in the Ohio River, and people dig them up every once in a while. I know personally of a guy who found a bunch of Roman coins. He dug them up. Fortunately, another friend took some pictures of them before he took them up to Chicago and sold them. I mean, they just come and go, you know. He knew that they were gold, so he went up and sold them, right? But there wasn't an artifact.
Yeah,
it was
he sell it for Malta for historical preservation?
Cares about things like that.
Or
and
they just
yet,
melted
here
it.
They are. Yeah, they would melt them down. It's really, I mean, this area is rich in ancient artifacts, and we're always pleased to have anyone who find stuff to come and talk to us about it. Last month we had a guy who brought a whole collection of stone tools that had been found in all kinds of areas by a sheriff. The sheriff was always called to these digs and stuff where they were going to dig up a build, you know, land for a building and stuff, and he would get the artifacts. And this, cool. And he willed them to this to this guy, and he brought them and you know, showed us pictures of them. It was
great.
Really, there's all kinds of stuff like that around here.
Oh,
so we have a very interesting group.
Such a need for a museum that will honor and accept these things.
Yeah.
Judy,
yeah.
Or
if I,
go ahead, Jay.
Well, if I can help in establishing a museum, it'll be the first diffusionist museum in the United States, in the world, actually.
In the world,
diffusionist,
it's much needed.
I was astonished.
Yeah.
I thought the Historical Society of Wisconsin up in Madison was going to be the. I was online to work for free for the next 10 years to build that museum there. And hired a new archaeologist that said, no way in hell was some of my stuff going to be exhibited. And the black stones from a cave, you know, on the Mississippi, he said. I mean, I think that his comment was so ignorant that he's a state former state archaeologist. His comment was so ignorant that is just it appalls me. But I don't think he's ever seen any artifacts. No one has ever, no academic has ever asked to see my artifact. We have a lot of stuff. I was going to give them millions of dollars worth of stuff, basically. All these decorated axes and all these carved stones. I've got four carvings of the Jesus. I mean, let alone Caesar and Cleopatra and all the rest of these people. And yet they consider them all fake. They don't want to see them. They won't even look at the evidence before they call it fake, which is just astonishing to me. So I am angry enough to say that I'm going to start my own dang museum, and probably in St. Louis, and exhibit this stuff while I'm still alive. You know, I'm not taking any pills yet. I turn 80 next year, but I think my friends and I are going to try to do this while we're still alive and make this stuff
good.
Public so that we can get this stuff out to and not just have it disappear.
Yeah.
Right. I think there's some people that want to help you too, Jay, you know.
There is
a very important.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Why are you interested in establishing a museum in St. Louis, just halfway
because
across the country?
It's the center of the United States. It's one of the world's major airports. It's got, if somebody lands there, they can rent a car, they can get the food, they can get a place to stay overnight. It's in a big place, you know, and it's close to major discoveries that we're going to be making in southern Illinois, and it's not hard to get there, okay? Now, I'm being asked to go up the river 2 hours and participate in a museum that's being put together by some Mormons, and they do have a nice thing. They have a replica of a Phoenician ship that was made from a discovery of a Phoenician ship off of the coast of France, and they sailed the replica from Lebanon to Florida, then chainsawed it up, and then these guys bought it for $370,000, shipped it to this site on the Mississippi, and are rebuilding it right now.
Wow.
But I can't go there because anybody that would have to go there has got a 2-hour drive to get there, and I think when I get talking with all my friends, that we'll end up putting this thing, if not as close as possible to the airport in St. Louis. That's the conclusion that I've come to, and I have support from a number of friends that is the right thing, that's the right place to put it. And so Well,
there's
I think
a lot of people.
The,
there's hundreds of us who have collections that, you say we're getting older. We want a safe, honorable place for them to go.
Bob Krepke is helping me with this. He's a former historian for Ford Motor Company, and he is hand in glove with me on trying to find get this thing worked out. And so is Wayne May and Peter, I think. So, I think we'll be able to put something together. And if people are interested in helping with this, they should contact Wayne May at Ancient American at the magazine, or coming to the conference and meet us. There's plenty of room to have people help us.
Still a lot of work to do, more discoveries to be made, and learn about those that have been found, and to get that to more and more people. APS is about education, and you, too, are part of that and contributing so much. Thank you. And thank you, Mark, for giving us a venue to help promote what we do.
Oh, I've really enjoyed working with you for 6 years or so.
Mm-hmm.
Might be seven. Mm-hmm. It's you've introduced us to some really interesting people. Lon Krieger's been a guest a couple times. I was able to find his. I lost the page. Lon's article on the horses gives some nice drawings of pre-contact horses, and that's Lon's article is followed by one of Jay's articles, and when Lon's been a guest with us, he's gone into a lot of detail about the Michigan garden beds.
Mm-hmm.
That's in issue number 123, and Axe Head of the Eastern Atlantic Islands by Jay follows that one. So I think you have so many very, very talented, insightful people just presenting unique looks at what we really don't know about America's prehistory,
Mark,
pre-contact.
You're almost out of
time. Oh, okay. Judy,
Mark, the next time you have Lon on, be sure to ask him about his experiences with UFOs. He's got some personal experiences.
Okay, we'll get into that too. And if anyone needs more information about the conference, you can go to aapscopper.com, and we have a couple minutes left. Judy, is there anything else the listeners may need to know? The lodging is there.
It's
at the
hotel.
Freezing
and snowing. We could be beautiful, warm, sunny. We never know what, but be prepared. Bring layers. We have exhibits. We have speaker panels after each day. The speakers all line up in the table panel, and people can ask questions, and very fun and interesting things happen there. We have a storytelling time on Friday night. Sales room, silent auction where people donate wonderful things, and enough room so that we can interact and network, and really good meals. They do terrific.
Okay.
All right.
I hate to cut you off. We're almost out of time. I just want to thank Judy, Jill, and Jay, and we'll see everyone next week.